Got my bearings. My name is Marty Kreisworth. I'm Dean of Graduate and Postdoctoral Studies and Associate Provost of Graduate Education at McGill, and it's a real pleasure to be here today. This is a unique event, but an important one, that it allows us people, and I'm Dean of Graduate Studies, but I also happen to be an English professor, so the humanities and English and SHRC is very near and dear to my heart. I also like to see events whereby we can display the kinds of things that we do in the humanities, and particularly the notion of actually producing knowledge, producing new knowledge, which is often given more credit to our peers and our friends in other disciplines. I think it's important to remember that it's something that we do, and we do it very well. Today is our contribution to a joint initiative by CAGS and SHRC. And it is engaging humanities and social scientists, and particularly the graduate students in these fields, in dialogue about opportunities and challenges for things like, and not exclusively, but things like social innovation, research, and building knowledge capital for Canada's future. We have to keep reminding ourselves that we do this. I think it's more the case now that we know this than we did, let's say, when I was a graduate student many years ago. But it's something that I think it's important to keep stressing and to keep working on to make sure the government understands it. Graduate students are, I don't really need to tell you in this audience, but graduate students are extraordinarily important. They're the engines of change and innovation in various fields. Their observations and experiences are important in defining what we need as individuals in society to move and thrive in the current century. Graduate students in their research can help identify emerging trends and even more importantly facilitate collaborations and conversations across the various disciplines within the humanities and social sciences and even beyond with the sciences and as well. Today's event will result in a report, so there will be some concrete action items afterwards. It's a report to SHRC that will inform the six future challenges that have been identified. And we have a question today that we're going to talk about. That's one of these future challenges. This is part of the SHRC report, Imagining Canada's Future, and it's central to sustaining a successful. Oh, got the slide. Okay. All right. We got to get the question. Sorry, there it is. That's okay. Oh, did you tell me to do it?
No.
Okay. Maybe I was supposed to do that. So today we're focusing on this question. What knowledge will Canada need to thrive in an interconnected, evolving global landscape? As we know, this global landscape has shifted considerably, and it shifts every year. Particularly in the last 15 years, and we have to understand how shifting demographies, changes in populations, changes in resources, changes in the environment, and changes in the way we think about these things, both from a social science point of view as well as from a humanistic point of view, can participate in providing new knowledge in order to help. In order for Canada to thrive in the 21st century, we need a deep understanding of, among other things, newcomer communities within the Canadian society, and the things that we do well, which is to talk about the languages, cultures, histories, and economic impacts of our own global populations. The talent and skills of graduate students are central to this endeavor. Today we have 7 graduate student speakers. Who come from a whole range of our social science and humanities programs at McGill. We have, by the way, about 100 programs, graduate programs at McGill, and if you really want to get down to the nitty-gritty, it's something like 400 if you count all the master's and PhD degrees and the options and so on. But these 7 students range across a number of areas, and they're going to look at this question from their own particular research perspective. We're also going to have you get involved in discussing the issues that come up from these talks. And as such, you will be contributing to this national dialogue in our report back to SHRC. We're very pleased today to also have a keynote speaker, somebody I've known for a very long time, even before I came to McGill. Will Straw, and part of the reason I knew him is because he's well-respected across the not only the Canadian but the global community. Will is now the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, and he's a professor in the Department of Art History and Communication Studies. He's published widely in lots of areas. I'm just going to name the general areas, cultural analysis, the relationship between media, cities, and cultural identity. I also am pleased to say he has won one of our awards for graduate teaching and supervision, which is we have awards for supervisors at McGill, and there aren't many of these people. There's two a year. And Will has been one of the recipients of that, so that means to me that he's not only a good researcher, but also a great mentor and supervisor for his students. He's not only producing knowledge, but producing those who will produce knowledge, and so on and so forth. Will is also involved in music to a great deal, and he's the senior music correspondent for the CBC Radio's Primetime and a popular music correspondent for Women's Television Network. He also has one of the largest collections of music, and I don't know what do we call them? Do we still call them magazines or Pulp Fiction or whatever?
I dumped all those.
Oh, you dumped those? Okay, he no longer has any collections in magazines anymore, but he does have music. His keynote address today is entitled Social and Cultural Research in Canada, What's Wrong and What's Right, and I'm told, but I'm looking forward to hearing it myself, that he will compare SHRC-related research in Canada with that is being done in other countries, looking at the ways in which research is organized, funded, and judged elsewhere. He also will then suggest what we might want to do to enhance the value of the social science and humanities. After Will's talk, there'll be a few questions. Please join me in welcoming Professor Will Straw.
Thank you, Marty. Did I say I was going to do all those things? And the CBC stuff, that was 20 years ago. Anyway. I want to say that a few talks I've given in the last few months have made me more nervous than this one. There are many people in this room across the campus who could speak just as authoritatively and certainly much more inspirationally about graduate research in Canada. I'm also sorry that I have to leave to go teach my last undergraduate course of the term for 3 hours at 2:30. So I won't be able to stick around for much of the discussion. To move to the different, like my PowerPoints, it's all on one thing. Sorry.
You can use the clicker. Okay, great.
I also want to acknowledge that here at McGill we're in the midst of an as yet unresolved conflict involving graduate labor, and I don't think we can think about the future of graduate research in Canada if we don't guarantee those who undertake academic labor a fair living wage and fair conditions in which to work. Now, 2 weeks and 30 minutes from now, my 50th doctoral supervisee will defend her dissertation. Reaching this milestone is the thing I'm proudest of in my long career. Thinking of her and thinking of this talk, I went back over the list of graduate students I've supervised in order to get some sense of where they are now. Here's a breakdown. You can read that pretty much? Okay. Now, two of my former supervisees, I'm sad to say, are deceased. This is what the others are doing. Now, we know from a conference board report that Canadians with PhDs have lower unemployment and greater participation in the workforce than other Canadians, although these statistics are no guarantee of well-paying jobs. I'm pleased that roughly, if you take the 35 out of 47, roughly 75% of my ex-supervisees have at least full-time, if not permanent, academic employment. Some of them are moving towards that. But I don't think I can take much credit for that. Most of them have benefited from McGill's stature as a university and also from the ongoing growth of my discipline, which is communication studies. Any university that doesn't have a communication studies program is thinking of opening one. Anyone that has one is facing incredible pressures to expand. And so in that sense, we're more fortunate than perhaps some other disciplines represented here, but I won't name them. Now, when I reflect on the research areas of the people on the list who are now in full-time academic positions, the first thing I want to note is that the range is wide. The topics I'm looking really at the top list here, the top line. The topics of their research include such things as Lebanese women's photography in the mid-20th century, the rockumentary as a media genre, the role of American music in post-World War II Korea, changes in attitudes to work in the early 2000s, internet economy in Israel, women's cyber fiction, Haitian diasporic culture in Montreal, Canadian film policy during the tax shelter years of the 1970s, salsa culture in Montreal, and the American B-movie of the 1950s. Now, the second thing, and this is important to me, I want to say about this list, is that many of these people did not stay to work in Canada. Some are working in Beirut, London, Berlin, New York, Pennsylvania, Cairo, and Tel Aviv. They came to McGill largely because its reputation was one of high-quality academic inquiry. They also came because the research system in Canada as a whole was deemed to be one of the world's best. Large numbers of these came between the late 1990s and, let's say, 2010. These were years in which the Canadian Research Chair Program, the expansion of team grants from SHRC and Quebec agencies, the hiring of younger, productive new faculty made Canadian universities exciting places to be. I remember about 2005, there was this group of newly hired faculty at McGill who had these regular dinners, and they let me sort of come once as an old guy. And there was sort of 25 people around a table, all freshly arrived at McGill, getting to know Montreal, and it was just the sense of excitement was incredible. The students who came, it was a great pleasure to involve many of them in collaborative research projects. In these projects, my students conducted research in an interdisciplinary fashion with scholars who worked in other disciplines, in other languages, and in other universities. And as someone who's a great supporter of the push in FQRSC and SHRC towards teams, I will say one of the amazing results of that is that faculty and graduate students in Montreal now work much more often with Francophone researchers in the other universities. And I've seen this over 20 years. It's a very, very significant change. The students who were part of these teams took up questions like, this was a long project, the place of culture in cities, or an interesting partnership grant, the challenges institutions face around the world in archiving their audiovisual heritage. Now, these students brought their research areas and questions with them to Canada, and they refined these research areas through ongoing contact with Canadian expertise, but they then took that research back with them to the places in which they now live and work. And their own research took shape in a dialogue between the concerns they brought with them, the things they learned from us here, and hopefully they still draw upon that in their exchanges with colleagues and students in their home countries. In fact, in many cases, I know they do. Now, I'm spending some time talking about the experience of these students because, to be honest, I'm suspicious, and I'll say this openly, when anyone attempts to come up with lists of the kinds of knowledge we need in Canada. I know SHRC has done this, so basically has almost every university in Canada, large or small. And I should point out at this point that I'm a big supporter of SHRC. It's been my privilege to serve on, and in some cases chair, SHRC committees which adjudicate grants. But I remain suspicious of attempts to establish research priorities for students or for faculty members. Graduate students and faculty are always bringing with them to McGill and other Canadian universities research interests which were formed in their life experiences and in the places in which they've lived and grown up. These interests, of course, hook up with larger questions and contexts, but they all bear the rich, deep textures of the backgrounds in which they are formed. This is one of the real strengths of a cosmopolitan and international university. Now, last week, I was at another university. I'll say it was only that it was east of Vancouver and west of Peel Street, reviewing its communications program. And the university, like most universities, had drawn up a list of, in fact, six areas in which it claimed it could establish research excellence. In fact, as I pointed out to the administrators I met, because when you review these programs, you sort of meet people up the ladder, there was only one area on this list that had any connection to what we might call shirk disciplines, and even that connection was a bit of a stretch. But at the same time, this university had developed real strengths in the areas of the humanities and social sciences. It had attracted grant money, it drew students both national and international to study in these areas. It was generating most kinds of evidence of scholarly productivity. And by many metrics, the social sciences and humanities were performing reasonably well at this university and certainly getting better. And when students and faculty were asked in what areas they needed new professors, these were not usually the areas listed in the university's list of priorities. In fact, the list of priorities had little relationship either to the strengths of the university at the present time or to the direction in which most of its community saw itself moving in a collective fashion. Now, when I look at the shirk list of future challenge areas, however, I see for the most part questions, areas that have been sort of floating around the top of a great deal of academic research for most of the last 20 years. Indeed, most of the questions here, it seems to me, took shape in research that was not driven by identified priorities, but which emerged from more or less unfettered inquiry. That research was refined, of course, in ongoing dialogue with other projects and other perspectives. But when I look at the ones that are maybe that I can vaguely have some connection to, closer to my area, the areas in which I work, let's say number 1, 3, 5, and 6. I could say a lot more about number 2, but I'm not going to do that. I can think of dozens of examples in each case of research which may have arrived at these questions but didn't begin there. In most cases, these questions seem to me like retroactive attempts to find common denominators across a wide range of specialized research projects. Et lorsque je vois la question de quelle connaissance le Canada aurait-il besoin pour bien réussir dans un monde interconnecté en rapide évolution, je ne peux pas m'empêcher de penser que c'est pas parce que le CRSH s'y intéresse que des étudiants que j'ai connus à McGill, comme Miranda Campbell, par exemple, Christine Mitchell ou Cheryl Thompson, se sont penchés sur ces questions dans leurs recherches spécialisées. My point is not to assert the absolute independence and privileges of the scholar over any kind of social accountability or prioritizing. I do believe, however, that high-quality, pertinent research depends on a very particular process by which research topics are informed, are formed and refined and held to account. The best kind of this process, in my view, is one which marshals the widest diversity of backgrounds and interests, which brings young scholars together with those who are more senior, which is shaped by the pressures, the stimuli of the public university and its surrounding communities, which is steeped in controversy and so on. And at this point, I would suggest that with all their faults, university communities offer more of this diversity and, in fact, solicit more of this accountability than any other public institution I can think of. It is the elaboration of research projects within conditions of ongoing exchange and judgment. It is within that that knowledge is produced. I don't think it comes from the carving up and handing out of pieces of high-level areas designated as priorities. That's why, for example, in 2015 and across so many disciplines, really interesting work is being carried out, for example, on the question of performance, what that means for theater, new media, public life, identity, sexualities, nationhood, and a range of other issues. That's why we have as well something called the urban humanities. I know Paul is interested in this, in which those who study architecture, media, film, literature, political theory, and so on are coming together around a profoundly shared set of ideas about the character of cities. And this is why the study of indigeneity is cutting sharply across most of the disciplines in the social sciences and humanities, not just as one more sub-area to be developed or one more identity to be acknowledged, but as a profound challenge to the ways in which we imagine knowledge, organize scholarly work, and rethink the social and ethical mission of the university. Now, these areas have not arrived in the academy magically or even organically. People have struggled and argued for them in both intellectual and institutional ways. But they have emerged in ways that at least depend at least in part on the independent pursuit of intellectual inquiry. And the strength of these areas is the result in no small measure of the ways in which universities challenge us through ongoing judgment. We are judged by our peers and so on, and controversy to make the case for our objects and arguments. Now a little word from my sponsor. In my home department, we've argued long and hard about the purpose and character of graduate research. We haven't always agreed. For example, there's disagreement about whether we should limit the number of doctoral students we admit, given what are believed to be weaknesses in the academic job market. I actually think we should just keep admitting as we have been. In a collective statement we produced in my department, we say the following, and I quote, "The future of the PhD in the humanities lies in supporting free and open exchange of ideas, knowledge, data, and analysis, and the technologies, practices, institutions, and legal structures that can sustain both scholarship and this freedom. It entails resisting technologies, practices, institutions, and legal structures that commodify scholarly practice and knowledge and access to them." Now, there are selfish reasons why I support these principles. One is that I've watched with some horror at what is happening to the British research system. In fact, I think about the only positive thing we could say about the British system right now is that by linking departmental budgets to research productivity, at least it has shown some commitment to research itself. And this has created opportunities for graduate students to work on collaborative projects, which are sometimes interesting. But these graduate students are now recruited more and more in a marketplace of short-term labor contracts and diminished institutional integration. And the result of all of this has been scholarly work rushed prematurely into print, the destructive administrative micromanaging of research careers, and the double traumas of plummeting morale and declining prestige for the system as a whole. All of my former supervisees who took positions in UK universities have either returned home or are seeking ways to do so. The two university systems I visited in the past few years which have most impressed me are those of Norway and Brazil. In Norway, as you may know, the national government has been committed to investing large amounts of energy revenues in social infrastructure like universities. Just like Alberta, This has resulted in a significant expansion in the number of full-time professors, postdoctoral fellows, and funded research projects. There's a strong commitment to hiring talented young scholars, and in my field, in the kind of cultural disciplines, there's a strong interest in scholars who have been trained in the Canadian system. Now, why is there this interest in Canadian scholars and the Canadian system? It's partly because our humanities training at the graduate level is seen as possessing several traits which my Norwegian colleagues want. The ability to combine advanced theoretical work with an awareness of the policy context by which culture is made and disseminated. That's seen as sort of distinctly Canadian. There's a strong interest as well in our system of research grants, and in particular in the ways in which they've encouraged the formation of interdisciplinary teams. These features of Canadian scholarship are seen as giving it a social value, but that social value is a function of the independence with which Canadian research projects are conceived and put into operation. The other system which impresses me, and I'm coming to my close, perhaps even more, is the Brazilian system, and particularly the Brazilian network of federal universities, which has expanded quite remarkably over the last decade or so. If you're working like I am on popular music and urban culture, there's nowhere in the world where equally interesting work is happening. I've been lucky to visit several times in the last few years and to receive at McGill an ongoing series of doctoral students, postdoctoral fellows, and faculty on sabbatical, although with the new forms we have to fill out, who knows if that will continue. That system is facing pressures now, I acknowledge, and I know that 250,000 people were on the streets of Sao Paulo yesterday protesting government corruption. But I'm impressed by a number of things in the Brazilian system, by the insistence on the integration of research and teaching, something you don't find, for example, in the Mexican system, and distressingly, we see under threat in some Canadian universities. But I'm particularly impressed by the close integration of faculty and students in focused, team-based research, which aspires to the highest quality and interest. Research whose parameters are defined by the curiosity of individual researchers, but by ongoing interaction with their social and cultural context, and by an ever-expanding dialogue with scholars around the world. the back and forth between Brazil and Canada these days has much to do with what I see as similarities in our research cultures, even though obviously the countries are very different. In both places, the borders between the social sciences and the humanities are porous, particularly in the cultural field. In both, the commitment to individual inquiry is balanced by a deep interest in collaboration, which is both formal and informal. And in both as well, there's been a strong commitment to the public university, to public support for research, and to a view of research which simultaneously protects its independence, but also seeks new ways of making it public. And so, these are the things I think we need to sustain in Canada. A strong commitment to public universities, an expansion of the graduate fellowships, postdoctoral funding, and research grants, which are a significant reason for our international success. If Norway and Brazil can do these, so can we. Thank you. Sure. Are there any questions or comments? Disagreements? Complaints? Favorite parts you want to hear over again? Okay, Paul.
So I think that it's because it was very full and very information packed, but really? Let me just ask you to say a little bit more about, we have some collaborative research and team research in relationship to the emphasis on curiosity driven research and on.
Thanks. And on the tradition of independent research, individual research, which is, has been so important in the history of the humanities.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of those who, you know, we all resisted it until we got on a team that we really, really liked. And I think, I mean, if I had another lifetime, I'd do a history of how humanities faculty got involved in grants. Well, originally it was to get a sabbatical travel. Then it was to buy a computer for $4,000. And then you had to dream up projects, and then there were opportunities to work together. And I just think, it's been perhaps the most rewarding part of my academic life because it has broken down, in particular, all kinds of barriers. Like I said, I now spend half my research life speaking French, which I didn't before, crossing disciplines, and I think that is perceived around the world as one of the strengths of the Canadian research system. I don't think everybody should be forced into it, and I know there are objections. But I don't, see it as, I might have said 15 years ago, as a corporatization of academic work or anything like that. I think it's one of the great jewels of the system, and Quebec in particular has benefited from that. Okay,